Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Later this hour, we'll be talking about COP30, the UN climate change conference. No one from the Trump administration showed up, but California brought a full delegation led by Governor Gavin Newsom. We'll talk about what deals the state cut. Then, if you're a fan of great fiction, you'll want to hear Ann Harper's interview with Shobha Rao, who has a new book, Indian Country. But first, you can't walk too far in San Francisco without coming upon a park, a green space, or a playground. The city has 220 of them. And for the last 16 years, Phil Ginsberg was the guy in charge as general manager of recreation and parks. He's stepping down at the end of the year, and he joins us now. Welcome to State of the Bay, Phil.
Thanks, Grace. It's an honor to be here.
But oh,
it's
my.
230 parks.
Oh, 230. I mean, I'm glad we got those other 10. Well, first of all, thank you for your 16 years of service. I mean, it's pretty incredible to have a tenure that long. And I know you've been with the parks even longer than that, 25 years in total. But when you began your job in 2009, I mean, take us back. What was the biggest challenge facing the parks and rec system?
I think the public didn't have a lot of confidence in our system. It was struggling. We had a lot of deferred maintenance, some tight budget years, labor challenges, perhaps a lack of professionalism in and out in the field, underinvestment, a lack of equity for communities that really needed our spaces most, some antiquated operational systems. It really wasn't a very highly regarded park system at the time.
Yeah, now people, the oft-quoted fact is that you can't walk 10 minutes without finding a park or an open space. And I mean, I thought about that today, given that, you know, this is a city that's 49 square miles, it's not huge, and yet you were able, with your staff, to accomplish that. What did it take to get there from where you started to where you've ended?
Well, as much as I'd like to take credit for all of that, you know, the fact that we have the most accessible park system in the United States is a credit to generations of San Franciscans. And, you know, a lot of really good planning decisions over well over 150 years. However, during, you know, my tenure, we were able to do some mapping. We began to understand what parts of our city lacked open space. You know, look, our city is in some respects just like nature and just like a park. It evolves, it changes, it grows. And we had neighborhoods back in the, I don't know, the mid 20th century that were very industrial and had no open space. And yet in the 21st century, they are residential, supported by families, different socioeconomic brackets. So part of our work was to really understand where we had green space and where we didn't. And we were very deliberate about trying to acquire open space and build new parks in communities that did not have them within a 10-minute walk. Sanford is one of my proudest accomplishments. In 2016, San Francisco became the very first city in the United States of America where 100% of us now live within a 10-minute walk of a park.
Well, I know one park that you are very rightly proud of is India Basin. And for people who might not know that park, tell us where it is and what listeners would find if they visited.
Sure. India Basin is in the Bayview, an area that actually has been historically park deficient. It is about 1.7 miles of waterfront on our southern waterfront. Most of your listeners are probably very familiar with our northern waterfront, Crissy Field, the Presidio, the Marina Green. But we have another waterfront in San Francisco that is absolutely incredible. But unfortunately, because of, you know, I think generations of unfortunate, arguably racist decision making, we put San Francisco put stuff in that neighborhood along that waterfront that nobody else wanted anyplace else. It suffered. It had a power plant, a wastewater treatment plant. The neighborhood was cut off by a couple of freeways. And so that waterfront became very industrial, mildly polluted. There was barbed wire cutting off the communities from the water. And we have been working over the last 15 years to re-envision that waterfront. Some people call it the Bayview's Crissy Field moment. And the true core of that effort is about a $225 million investment in the Bayview to revitalize that community's waterfront. And what I'm most proud about is that we've done it with the Bayview community. We're about halfway through the project, but if you go out there today, you'll see a beautiful, beautiful new park at 900 Innes that really reflects the community in its art, in its culture, in its program, in its economic opportunity for Bayview residents who are operating a food pavilion, in the youth opportunities it provides at a really wonderful nonprofit called Rock in the Boat that is teaching kids how to build boats, literally build boats and bring them out on the water. The park has, rocking chairs. I don't know. It's
It's
really
beautiful.
amazing.
I've been there.
It's
I mean, it is
beautiful.
really beautiful and a testament to not just plopping a park down into a community, but I mean, just from what you've described and what I've read is it really you built that up from a groundswell of community support. I mean, you took time, the you and the department took time to figure out what the community there wanted versus just giving them a park that you thought they would like.
Yeah. Thank you. That was the key, really, to making sure that this space really worked for this community that has long deserved it.
You know, in contrast, another park that's recently opened is Sunset Dunes that came with the closure of part, not all, but part of the Great Highway. And that's a park that has been such a source of controversy and one in which the community seems at odds with whether they actually want this park or not. And I wonder, you know, looking back on that, what went right and what went wrong with the creation of that park?
So let's compare Sunset Dunes and the conversion of a highway or roadway that was formerly called the Great Highway to this very same discussion a little bit to the east on the what was once called JFK Drive, but is now called the JFK Promenade in Golden Gate Park. There had been a debate about whether that particular road should serve cars or people for well over half a century. Literally. At one point, it was closed just on Sundays. And then before my parks job, I spent some time working for Mayor Newsom and mediated. I was the mediator in this one between the two disparate communities that wanted to close that road on Saturdays. And then the pandemic came around and we all needed more space, and the road was closed during the pandemic and people fell in love with the space. So I would say the one thing, the one ingredient perhaps that has been missing in the development of this magical, magical park that we now call Sunset Dunes, that is already San Francisco's third most visited space, is time. We like to call ourselves a progressive city, but we are a progressive city that hates change.
I think that's fair. So when you say we need time, would you like to see whatever District 4 supervisor Mayor Lurie ends up appointing embracing the park?
100%. Here's what people need to understand that may not, I guess we didn't communicate at least to the Sunset community as well as we needed to. Now, let's remember this park did pass with nearly 60% of San Francisco supporting it. This road, the Great Highway, is going away regardless. It's not if, it's when. Mother Nature bats last. This road is crumbling into the ocean. It was when it was operating as a highway, it was often closed because of all the sand that had moved onto the road that constantly needed to be shoveled and moved. North of Sloat along the Great Highway, that road is already dead, separate and apart from the creation of Sunset Dunes. So what San Franciscans decided to do was to take this 2-mile stretch of road and ask people to travel on Sunset Boulevard, just a few blocks away, that has plenty of capacity when moving north or south between Sunset, between Sloat and Lincoln. There are no other cross streets that actually access Sunset Dunes. So if you're coming from the north, now the answer is turn left on Lincoln and then head south on Sunset Dunes. And if you're traveling from the south north, take Sunset Boulevard to Lincoln, turn left, and then turn right on Great Highway and continue your drive. What we get instead has been magic. People walking their dogs, biking. I've seen more kids out there than I have ever seen in my 35 years living in San Francisco.
Well,
I've seen more families out there in my than I've ever seen in my 35 years in San Francisco. And yes, for some people it has been inconvenient, and we need to honor that. But that's what living in a city is all about. It's
exactly.
actually sharing our public realm. Nobody owns it, we share it.
Well, before I let you go, I mean, one issue that has marked your tenure has been the explosion of the San Francisco Park Alliance. And I know you've addressed this before, but as you are ending your tenure in this job as general manager of the Rec and Parks, what do you have any regrets about how the Parks and Rec handled its relationship to the Park Alliance?
I really don't, Grace. I mean, if I had a crystal ball, I would have used it. I want to set some context for this. First of all, I think the way they handled their finances is it was horrible. It was irresponsible. I'm really, really upset, in part because it has, to a certain extent, tarnished some of the work we've been able to do together. But what has made San Francisco's park system so incredible is, in part, is the $300 million in philanthropy that we have been able to cultivate over my tenure. Every major city in the country that operates a park system has a major nonprofit that it partners with to help it. That actually, people don't like to give money to government, right? They give money to community. The Parks Alliance was made up of a board and staff of people that lived in San Francisco that loved their parks. Unfortunately, they were reckless and irresponsible with their finances. The fact that they were struggling financially a little bit, what nonprofit didn't coming out of the pandemic? But what was inexcusable was that they used restricted sources of funds where people gave them gifts for a specific purpose. They used it to cover their own operating expenses. So it sucks. But the parks community has been resilient. There's a group of people that have worked really hard to already raise some of the money that some of our community groups that literally sweat for our parks every day, they've been able to make them whole. So we'll bounce back from this. And, in the big picture, we have to look at, just how much good we've been able to accomplish. Philanthropy has often been described, if government provides the margin of survival, sometimes philanthropy provides the margin of excellence. And we've relied on a lot of philanthropy from a lot of really wonderful San Franciscans, foundations, civic leaders to make our park system the best in the country.
Well, it certainly is a diamond for the city, and we have you to thank, Phil Ginsberg, for your leadership. And thank you for being here at State of the Bay tonight.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll turn to the global stage. California made waves at the United Climate Conference, COP30. What does it mean for climate policy here at home? Stay with us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. After a Richmond woman's son is shot, she's confronted with a question.
And the doctor was so excited, and he said, "Everything about your son is so, oh my God, it was like his heart, his this, his that, is just perfect. Do you want to donate?"
Exploring the complex feelings around organ donation in Black communities. Tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Governor Newsom's visit to this year's United Climate Conference, COP30, drew crowds, headlines, and no shortage of political scrutiny. While the Trump administration and many corporate executives failed to show up, Newsom brought a high-profile delegation, and there was plenty of enthusiasm and, depending on who you ask, a fair amount of star power. So let's ask somebody who was actually there on the ground in Brazil. That would be State Senator Josh Becker, who represents Silicon Valley, the peninsula, and he was part of the governor's climate delegation. Welcome to State of the Bay, Senator.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with your experience on the ground. The Trump administration did not send a delegation to the conference. Was that absence noticeable, talked about?
Oh, it was extremely noticeable and extremely talked about, for sure.
Well, when the U.S. fails to participate in something like that, does that just give other nations cover to not participate, to not care about the climate?
What does it do? I mean, the people who are there, right? I mean, you're surrounded by thousands of people who are true believers, right? These are people who are passionate about climate and passionate about reversing the dangerous path that we are on. And so it's become something more like despair when the U.S. doesn't show up. I mean, this is, don't forget, you know, Rio really kind of kicked this all off many years ago. And this was the first COP that the U.S. did not send a federal delegation to. So, it becomes extremely concerning to the rest of the world, much more so than anything else, I would say. And so luckily we're there to help fill the gap. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But people get like really, really honestly, like just depressed, you know, like despondent if the U.S. is not there. It's true.
Well, so let's talk about California's reception at this conference. Were other countries and governments skeptical about California's participation, or did it feel like the state was offering the leadership that needed to happen in the void?
Yeah, no, I can't tell you the number of people who came up to me personally, just were so grateful that I was there, so grateful that California was there, so grateful the governor was there. So many people just came up, and I think they understood, and certainly my talk, you know, number one, I've made it very clear, I've made it very clear that President Trump does not speak for all Americans, and that I know there is a despondency out there, and, you know, I came to share a very different story, one built upon the determination, innovation, the hope of that drives millions of Americans, and to share that in California, we continue to believe by wide margins that confronting climate change and accelerating clean energy investment, clean energy deployment is not only a environmental priority, but also a moral, a economic, and a public health imperative. So I think we shared all that, and then we shared the actual progress. It's not just words. You know, we're 70%, our grid is almost 70% clean now. We had 9 out of 10 days the first half of the year where we had at least part of the day was 100% clean energy, an average of 7 hours a day for those 9 of 10 days. You know, 29% of the cars sold last quarter were EVs, or about 7% of the fleet. The list goes on and on, the 16 gigawatts of batteries that we've built just in the last 5 years. It's just a tremendous accomplishment the governor's been talking about recently. So it's not just that. And you know, and by the way, I learned a lot of good news too. But we were able to share a lot of good news, a lot of substance.
Well, the governor announced several new agreements at COP30. And I'm just curious, I mean, a state can't really enter into treaties themselves. So what kind of agreements were they, and how will they benefit the state?
Well, for example, this MOU with the state of Pará, that's the state that we were at. Again, this is the first ever COP in the Amazon region. And I've been doing a lot about helping getting California off of oil from the Amazon. We actually do believe it or not, import a lot of oil because particularly kind of heavy crude that our refineries are optimized for. But it was a whole different level just to be there in that state, in the state of Pará, in the gateway to the Amazon region. And came back with a lot of additional motivation and as well as again tools and relationship to work on this. But particularly they signed an MOU that was really around wildfire prevention and enhanced forest monitoring, which of course is a huge issue in California. I chaired the budget subcommittee where we've made a lot of investments around wildfire detection, early detection, early suppression. They didn't worry about this in the Amazon, but you know, 2 years ago they had big fires, which is a huge warning sign for the planet. I mean, to say it's the lungs of the planet, I think we always sort of said that. It felt more like a throwaway line to me. Now I really understand why it is the lungs of the planet, the 4 billion trees there. But they're at about 29% deforested, and they actually had wildfires because of drought, you know, because of conditions. So that's one. In Denmark, we signed an MOU jointly tackling the challenge of data center decarbonization. And that's obviously a huge issue, not just in California, but across the country. And I was at the subnational first in Rio with Secretary of Natural Resources Wade Crowfoot before going to Belém. And there's a lot of sharing there. But I also talked to a lot of cities like Melbourne, Australia, as well as Phoenix, Arizona, that are really struggling with this data center issue. And so Denmark is a place that has been leading with offshore wind and grid flexibility. And so that MOU, I think, could be very helpful to us as well.
You know, what's so hopeful in what you're saying is that you can make change at a more local level, even when our government, our federal government, doesn't participate. There are things that you were able to get done. And I know decarbonization is something that you believe, and many people believe, is a climate imperative, but also an economic imperative. Do you want to share a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. One of the things that came out of this, I'm actually launching a good news climate blog. So if you
I'm announcing it here first.
If you check my website in about my official website in about a week, it should be up. Because I learned a lot of good news. We were sharing good news, but learning a lot of good news. You know, Australia is 63% coal. They're going to be off of coal in 7 years. Wow. And you know, I've been there when they started that process. And now they're, you know, accelerating dramatically with 3 different institutions that they've. Around finance and that they've stood up to accomplish that goal. You know, again, being chair of the Senate Energy Committee was meaningful. I was able to share a lot of our progress on decarbonization. But it's not just state, it is the local level too. You know, each of us state senator represents 1 million people. So I'm determined to use my platform. I have 100,000 people that open my newsletter. And I want to make sure I'm getting good information to them about how to decarbonize their homes and the benefits of doing so and the benefits of getting a heat pump and an induction cooktop stove. So there's a lot that we can drive both of our local cities as well as the statewide level. So we're doing that at the home level. You know, I'd gotten some money specifically for East Menlo Park, which is a historically African-American, historically lower income area. And a lot of people didn't have a chance to put in air conditioning or the money to put in air conditioning, didn't need it, but now they do. Now they can put a heat pump in, get air conditioning and, you know, greenhouse gas free heating. The big emphasis also has to be on existing buildings. And so I worked on passing what's called a building performance standard. It's sort of the evidence-based best practice across the country now of how you tackle emissions from large buildings. And so we'll be building on that, no pun intended, here in California in the next couple of years. Yeah.
Well, it was so great to get your bird's eye or on the ground view of what happened at COP30. And thanks so much for spending time with us this evening, Josh.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that was Senator Josh Becker. He has a good news blog coming out, people. If you're one of the 100,000 people who are reading it, something else to look forward to. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. Tonight, we're discussing California's presence at the United Climate Conference, COP30, and asking the question of, should California be taking an international leadership role on climate, or should we be focusing on issues at home? You can chime in and add to the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We're going to shift our conversation from what Josh Becker told us about to dig into what it all means at home. And here to explain that to us is State of the Bay's own Ethan Elkind. When he is not hosting this show, he directs the climate program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley School of Law. Welcome, Ethan.
Well, it's great to be with you, Grace. Lots of fun.
Yeah. We're also joined by Isabel Ruick. She's a Bay Area native and a State of the Bay, the State of the Bay's unofficial COP correspondent. She attended her fourth COP this year, representing the island of Vanuatu. Welcome, Isabel.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So, Ethan, let's start with you. You've been attending these conferences on and off for a very long time, and I know you weren't there in person this year, but give us some historical context. The California delegation is often treated like rock stars. What was your impression of the splash that Governor Newsom made on this, his first trip to COP?
Well, absolutely. California has really been rock stars, as you said, at these climate conferences. Of course, the U.S., when there's a favorable federal administration, is critical. They're the ones actually negotiating. Those federal negotiators are the ones who can help actually determine what the international agreement might look like. But everyone really knows that California has been a pioneer within the United States, really across the globe, on climate action. The public here in California is very supportive of climate action. The state just has a lot of the ingredients to be a climate leader. I mean, in addition to that public support, we've got the industries here, and we've got a lot of favorable conditions for things like renewable energy and the kind of investment that we need from private philanthropy and venture capitalists. So it all really comes together in California. And I think Governor Newsom, to get to your question about the splash he might have made there in Brazil, I think it's sort of twofold with him. I mean, I think probably you can't discount the fact that he's essentially running for president. He hasn't announced it, but all of the signs indicate that. And so a lot of people want to hear what a potential future president might have to say on this issue and get to know him and attend his speeches. So I think he brings a lot of cachet just as a potential presidential contender. But beyond that, given the moment that we're in, what you just heard Senator Becker talk about, the absence of federal leadership really magnifies California's role. And so I think it was just really symbolically critical for Newsom to be there. And it's an opportunity for him to raise both his and California's profile on the international stage at a time when the federal government is pulling back from climate action.
Hmm. Some of the partnerships that Senator Becker was talking about touched directly on areas where the Bay Area is strong, clean tech and methane monitoring, research collaborations. From your vantage point, do you think that these are agreements that could bring economic benefits or innovation opportunities to the Bay Area, or are they mostly symbolic?
Well, in some ways, they're sort of both. I mean, they're symbolic in the sense that the political leadership wants to show that it's still moving forward. California leadership wants to show that they're able to step into that void when the federal government is retreating. But they do carry actual meaningful economic benefits for the region. I mean, all the issues that when we think about what we need to make progress on to attack climate change, to reduce emissions, that involves investment in technologies, many of which were incubated here in California. Many of those companies are based here in California. We don't have a strong manufacturing base, but we do have leading manufacturers like Tesla, for example, at their Fremont plant. So there are manufacturing jobs and certainly other types of business benefits that really redound to California's benefit when we have these kinds of international agreements. And the other piece of it, too, is that California cannot go it alone. The more that we can expand the market for climate technologies, clean technologies, the cheaper they become overall, and the cheaper it makes it for people in California to do things like what Senator Becker was talking about, adopt heat pumps, buy electric vehicles, invest in charging infrastructure. The more we can help other markets deploy those technologies, then the overall cost will come down and make it cheaper for us to meet our climate goals too.
Isabel, you attended COP30 representing the island nation of Vanuatu. For people who don't know where that island is located, tell us a little bit about it and how you came to be its representative at the conference.
Definitely. Vanuatu is an island located in the South Pacific, kind of between Australia and Fiji. It's actually a pretty popular tourist destination for people from Australia and New Zealand. But since the kind of origination of the UN like COP conference on climate change, Vanuatu and other Pacific small island developing states have been real champions of climate action, advocating, especially in the last 10 or so years, even before that, for not bridging or not going above 1.5 degrees Celsius. They've been real powerful forces in this international arena. And I was really, really keen to support them and learn from them, specifically when it comes to this topic of loss and damage. Typically, when we think of climate change and responses, we think of mitigation, which is reducing our emissions, adaptation, which is how we are going to adapt to the effects of climate change. Loss and damage is really this third prong that small island developing states have really elevated to the international arena that focuses on how we respond to the effects of climate change that we cannot adapt to. So when a natural disaster happens that has been heightened or exacerbated by climate change and causes loss of life or loss to cultural heritage or damages infrastructure, that's really where we're talking about that loss and damage. And so it's been a privilege to be able to support them in their negotiations and to learn from true experts in this area.
Well, the last three COPs you attended were hosted by, I mean, what we could call petrostates, such as Azerbaijan and the United Arab Emirates, Egypt. Some negotiators said that COP30 in Brazil kind of felt like a reset after these three oil-aligned hosts. Did it feel different to you in that way?
I think definitely it felt different. This COP is critical. I mean, every COP is. It's not only because it's the 30th COP, but because it's following the full completion of the Paris Agreement rulebook. So this is really where we're starting to focus on implementation. This felt like a real opportunity to prove that multilateralism is working, especially after the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Agreement and a delegation not being there this year. So this did kind of feel symbolic in a lot of ways. I think the blessing of it being in Brazil really highlighted what climate change really looks like for people. So walking through the halls when you're in the conference center, it was super hot. It was really hard to do the work. People, you know, you're kind of under duress because of the weather, and it's a real reminder of what climate change looks like on the ground. There was a lot of criticism of this COP being hosted in Belém in Brazil, which is relatively, quote unquote, underdeveloped compared to other parts of the country. There's less infrastructure, it's harder to get to. But I think it's a real reminder of like what these conferences are trying to deliver, which is real impacts on the ground. And sometimes they feel very removed from that. And I think in hosting it in Brazil and with the leadership of the COP presidency here, they really showed kind of the juxtaposition of what it means to be fighting climate change while you still, like, you're trying to protect the Amazon, but you are also still focusing on oil deals and the reality that countries are facing in transitioning their economies away from being a petrostate into being a country that supports more of a just transition. I think Brazil really highlighted that excellently.
Well, tonight we're at This is State at the Bay on local public radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your host, Grace Wan, and tonight we're discussing California's presence at the United Nations Climate Conference, COP30, and we'd love to hear from you. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or find us on social media, or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We're joined by State of the Bay co-host Ethan Elkind, who directs the climate program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley School of Law. We also have Isabel Ruick, who attended COP30 this year as the representative for the island of Vanuatu. Ethan, I wanted to turn back to you. I mean, how much do the decisions made at COP30 actually impact California's regulatory or legislative approach to climate solutions? Are our agencies taking cues from these conferences, or do we get to still chart our own course?
Well, there's sort of two answers to that question, Grace. I mean, at a basic level, they don't really have direct impact on what California regulators and legislators do. We have our sovereignty to make policies, for example, with respect to our electricity grid. We can set goals, and we have set goals to decarbonize our electricity grid and are making great progress on renewable energy. Up until this summer, we had sovereignty essentially to set tailpipe emission standards for vehicles, just as a few examples of climate action. We have a lot of other laws on the books and regulations to try to reduce methane emissions, to try to address emissions from all different sorts of sectors of our economy. And none of that is directly affected by what happens internationally. It's much more affected by what might happen at the federal level in the U.S. to the extent that they start to sort of intrude on California's sovereignty. But they do help California to that point I was making earlier, that to the extent that other countries are motivated to embrace maybe stronger climate action or just climate action at all, and these conferences can really shine a light on them and create some political pressure for them to do so at home, to the extent that they're moving forward on climate, as I was saying, that creates a bigger market for the technologies that we need to deploy. It creates more testing grounds, essentially, for seeing how programs and policies play out in other jurisdictions that we may want to adopt in California, or that we can help influence those countries, those jurisdictions to adopt. So it does overall move the dial on climate action worldwide, which does benefit California. But, you know, we're going to chart our own path regardless of what the federal government does and regardless of what happens at these international conferences. It's just that the more that parties at the conference are moving forward on climate action, the greater benefit to California. And of course, we can't also forget the idea that California is uniquely vulnerable in many ways to climate change. I mean, maybe not perhaps as much as Isabel's country there, Vanuatu, but you know, we are facing wildfire, extreme heat, sea level rise, flooding, all the types of things that scientists forecast would hit California. And so the more other countries agree to reduce emissions, the more that incrementally helps protect Californians from a worsening, changing climate.
Isabel, when you go back to speak to your compatriots from Vanuatu about what you saw and the lack of American leadership, but the presence of California leadership, what do you hear back from the people of Vanuatu and other delegates?
I have to say that in the negotiating rooms, the lack of U.S. presence is not necessarily a topic of conversation, at least in my experience. I think the impacts of climate change, the need to address it, is so severe, especially for countries like Vanuatu. The U.S. not being there, you can't really afford to spend time being concerned about that. I will say, though, that the U.S. is typically considered to be a party that really focuses on bilateral meetings between countries. They put together bridging proposals and are really focusing on compromise and moving negotiations forward in many ways. And there's a gap that's been left by the U.S. not being there. I had the opportunity just to sit in on a few negotiations on gender, and you can see without the U.S. there really being a super strong vocal advocate publicly for more gender equality, it gives room for more conservative countries to share their views without kind of that pushback from a powerhouse like the United States. So there definitely is that role. I think outside of the negotiating rooms, California being there, Governor Newsom being there, was definitely a huge topic of conversation. I saw him walk through the halls. There was a huge crowd following him. He was almost treated with a kind of presidential status by a lot of the people there. He was really stepping into the shoes of the U.S. Other governors were there from the United States. They did not receive that level of attention. So I have to say, personally, as a Californian, I had a lot of pride. I think it reminded me, or kind of showed me, the value of subnational actors in this space. I think so often we're thinking at the international level in these arenas that we kind of forget about that bridge that's so critical to being able to deliver action at that level. And Governor Newsom being there and talking about the efforts that are being made in California and the role that California is playing in promoting climate action was really hopeful. And I think for a lot of Americans who were there, who didn't feel that sense of leadership, the California delegation that went really offered that and reminded us that we can still be proud climate advocates as Californians and as Americans, regardless of who we have as president right now.
Yeah, and to clarify, by subnational, we're talking about states and everything below the federal level. Is that right, Isabel?
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ethan, I mean, so California was at this conference. Are there other states from the U.S. that participate in this conference, or if not, are at least good partners to California in its effort to reach decarbonization, to reach its ambitious climate goals?
Yeah, we're seeing subnational action. I think Isabel's absolutely right to point out how important that is all across the U.S. So states like Oregon and Washington have adopted California's low carbon fuel standard, which basically requires that fuel sold in the state has to have a decreasing percentage of carbon intensity over coming years, eventually zeroing out. Other states like Washington and Oregon have also looked into a cap and trade program, emissions trading programs. We see that in the Northeast as well, emission trading programs under the sort of REGI acronym out there. And many states have adopted targets for renewable energy deployment. And a whole bunch of states signed on to California's tailpipe emission standards before those were struck down by Congress. We'll see if litigation prevails on that front. But absolutely, there's a lot of states moving forward, and a number of those governors, as Isabel referenced, did attend COP30, but it's California just really has that kind of star aura about itself when it comes to this issue of climate. Environmental action is really synonymous with California. It's why so many people move to the state because of our climate and our scenery. We have so many industries and economic value wrapped up in the beauty of the state and our pleasant climate. And so it's just an imperative for California. It always really has been. We've been a leader on environmental action, you know, for well over a century. And this is really just a continuation of that mantle that California has.
Well, Ethan and Isabel, before I let you go, Ethan, I wanted to ask you about kind of the evisceration of research related to climate and environmental protections that has happened in the last year with the Trump administration. Are there international sources that we can rely on, or are we just losing a generation's worth of research and development?
Well, it's bad. I mean, all the cutbacks to science research by the federal government is rough. Many grants, including grants to where I work at University of California, Berkeley, including at our research center, have been revoked, suspended. I will say there's been a lot of victories at the court level. And so a lot of that funding has, not a lot, but a fair amount of it has been reinstated. Ultimately, though, it's not so much international sources, but private philanthropy that's going to have to step in until we see a change in priorities at the federal government level again.
Hmm. Well, we'll all have to look at Josh Becker's Very Happy Good News blog for better news. And there's so much more to discuss, but I'm afraid that's where we'll have to leave it for tonight. Earlier, we heard from California State Senator Josh Bender about his attendance at COP30, and we've heard from Ethan Elkind, co-host of KALW's State of the Bay and director of the climate program at UC Berkeley School of Law. Thanks so much for being here, Ethan.
Yeah, my pleasure. So much fun to be with you, Chris.
I know. So much fun to talk to you. We've also heard from Isabel Ruick. She's the advisor to the Vanuatu Climate Ministry and our unofficial State of the Bay COP correspondent. Thanks so much for joining us, Isabel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Coming up after the break, Ann Harper will sit down with author Shobha Rao to talk about her new book, Indian Country. Stay tuned.
KALW is your home for music discovery. We're excited to present Living Legends. The indie hip-hop supergroup emerged from the Bay in the 90s, getting their start selling mixtapes on Telegraph. Living Legends come to UC Theater December 5th with Souls of Mischief, an all-ages show featuring some of the Bay Area's golden era artists. Details on Living Legends at the UC Theater at kalw.org/presents.
The KALW On-Air Folk Festival returns this Saturday. It's 5 hours of live music performed by our stellar musicians, covering Celtic, bluegrass, fingerstyle guitar, and singer-songwriter music. Join us for our 5-hour folk festival starting at 2 o'clock this Saturday on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your fellow music traveler. Join me weeknights from 8 to 10 p.m. as we cross genres, generations, and go all across the musical map, discovering forgotten favorites, future favorites, and all the journeys in between. That's Monday through Friday nights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on 91.7 KALW and KALW.org. Join us for the ride.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. Sometimes when I finish a book, I can't stop thinking about it. The characters, the plot, the setting, they stick with me long after I've turned the last page. And that is what happened with Shobha Rao's latest novel, Indian Country. The story follows a newly married Indian couple who move from a city on the River Ganges to a rural Montana town. And it wrestles with some big themes like colonialism, misogyny, the weight of unfulfilled hopes. It's a haunting and beautiful book, and we're thrilled to have the author with us here tonight, Shobha Rao. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having me, Anne.
Congratulations on the publication of Indian Country, your sophomore novel. I sort of gave it away in the intro, but I did not put it down, and I'm so excited to talk with you about it. So, like I mentioned, it follows this young newlywed couple who've moved to Montana from India, and there are many additional elements that we'll get to later. But for the uninitiated, can you tell us a bit about the story and what drew you to write this?
Absolutely. I'll start with the second part first. So when I moved to the United States, I was 7 years old, and I didn't know very much English, maybe a handful of words. And I remember within the first week or two of arriving in the United States, I was at recess, and this little boy came up to me, and he said, "What are you?" You know, in the way that little kids do. And I said, "I'm Indian." And he said, "Oh, well, what tribe are you in?" And I just looked at him. I had no idea what he was talking about. I didn't know any of the history that he was coming from. And as I grew up, I realized that 500 years ago, Columbus had landed in the New World and mistakenly, or maybe not so mistakenly, declared that he had arrived in India and thereby named the indigenous Indians. And so that historical mistake has lived in me all these years, literally from within a week of landing in the United States. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's become complicated, and I've learned so much about all kinds of peoples in North America and in the Americas in general. But certainly that was the genesis of the book. And the more I thought about Native communities and history in India, colonization and the British Empire, taking resources and subjugating people, I thought on the surface, there's no similarities, right, between Native American history and Indian history from India. But if you go deeper, I think we can find a common place of history living out in our lives to this day, history that maybe happened hundreds of years ago. And I think that's what I wanted to sort of explore and celebrate in the novel.
Mm-hmm. And part of the way you do that is through these two rivers that are central to the story, the Ganges in India and the Cotton River in Montana, which is fictional, but based on the Tongue River. So tell us why rivers are such an important part of this story for you.
Of course. So rivers, symbolically or metaphorically, they're similar to life, the flow of them, the unending sort of quality of them. And so there is that component. But personally speaking, being raised Hindu, I've always considered rivers sacred, and not just rivers. I mean, all creatures, right? Man is equal to everything else. So we're equal to a river, which is equal to, you know, a little ant or a beetle on the ground. And so growing up with understanding of the sacredness of rivers and mountains and forests, and certainly the Ganges or the Ganga, as we call it in India, it's considered by Hindus to be the holiest river in the world. And Varanasi, which is where the two characters meet and eventually marry, is considered the holiest city in the world. So moving that story and that couple to southeastern Montana, a rural place, the Tongue River or the Cotton River in my novel, is kind of a small river relative to the Ganges. But that doesn't make it any less sacred. And I really wanted to have the characters in my novel and the reader themselves come to that exploration of, oh, maybe rivers are sacred. Maybe when we traverse them, we follow a symbolic sacred path. And so that's how the rivers came into being.
So can you tell us a bit about the story?
Sure. So Janavi and Sagar, our couple, are forced into a marriage that neither of them really want because of some duplicitous action of Genevieve's sister. The couple then move to Montana because Sagar, who is a hydraulic engineer, is hired to take down a dam on the Cotton River. And within the first few months of his work, the body of a Native American woman is found dead at the base of the dam. And so Sagar gets scapegoated, loses his job. And the couple then, you know, spend the rest of the novel trying to figure out why this woman died and how she died. And so it's an immigration story. It's a love story. It's also a murder mystery. So it's got all those elements in it.
And you weave in 12 short fable-like stories in between some of the chapters that span centuries, which is an unconventional structure. Can you talk about why you wanted to include those and how they illuminate the larger story?
Sure. So in researching the novel, I came across this article about the Highway of Tears in British Columbia. It's a 450-mile stretch of highway where dozens of Native First Nations women and girls have gone missing or been found murdered. And in the article, there was an elder in one of the First Nations tribes that said, our girls and our women, they've been forgotten, right? And she was referring to the police and the detectives and investigative forces, because most of these murders and missing women have gone unsolved. And so I remember walking away from the article and thinking, no, something has to remember. And I think over time, the conviction grew in me that land and waters remember. They carry human memory. They carry the memory of our battles and our sorrows and joys. And so those vignettes were examining that sort of memory in land and waters over time.
Nice. So as you mentioned, you moved from India to the U.S. when you were 7 years old. Did you remember much of your childhood in India?
Oh, gosh, Anne, yes. I think my formative years were in India, right? I have distinct, they're not always linear, as childhood memories are often not. And then my parents did this amazing thing, which at the time I was kind of grumpy about, but they would take us to India every summer or every other summer while I was growing up. And we went to this little village in South India with no running water and electricity going in and out and none of the creature comforts we have in the United States. And yet, in my memory, they stand as the most beautiful summers of my life. And I grew closer to my relatives, certainly, but also to my culture and my identity over the course of those summers.
And do you think those experiences shaped you as a writer?
Oh, absolutely. I think having two cultures in one's life to illuminate that life and to give it context and perspective, it's been an incredible gift that is often missed in the conversation around immigration or cross-cultural dialogue, is how much richer life can be, right? If you can exist in two cultures and have both dialogues within yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the two main characters in the book, Sagar and Genevieve, face suspicion and prejudice as newcomers to the U.S. that, you know, struggles that feel especially relevant today. What do you want readers to take from their search for belonging at this moment?
Yeah, I think in many ways this is an aspirational novel in the sense that I wanted people to read it and see the ways in which we're connected more than different. We all have to live, you know, journey through our lives. And to say, oh, you're different because the color of your skin is different or the country of your origin is different or whatever, it deprives us of a kind of joyous connection and humanity that we can find in any other human being, regardless of where they come from and what language they speak, et cetera. And I think one of the things that I want to explore in this novel, and I consider it to be sort of a universal thing, is that the search for home is nothing to do with, you know, whether you're born and raised in a certain place and have never left, it doesn't matter. I do feel that the search for home is absolutely common to every single human being. And that home, it can shift. Some, you know, when we're young, it's with our parents. And when we get older, maybe it's a romantic partner. And for me, at times, it's been literature, you know, and books. But home, the search for it, the finding of it, the losing of it, all of that, I think, is a commonality and a universal search that we all have to embark on.
Well, that's all we have time for. We've been talking to local author Shobha Rao. Her latest novel, Indian Country, is available in bookstores now. I encourage listeners to pick up a copy. It's a really beautiful read. Thank you so much for joining us, Shobha.
Thank you for having me, Anna. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. Join us next week. Actually, next week we are off for Thanksgiving. So enjoy yourself, and I hope you have great plans for some good, delicious turkey. Remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen. Never miss an episode. And if you have any questions or comments about what you heard tonight, email us, stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper and Chris Nooney. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Stay tuned to another hour of KALW with the podcast in residence, Not Born Yesterday. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.